why have the promises of Western economic help for Russia been slow to materialize?
Well, we have the G7 countries all having their own economic difficulties. They all have their own problems at home. People don't like to send money to foreign lands when they think it's a giveaway. There aren't enough people who understand their selfish stake in this. And on a broader terms, their stake is even larger than I described, because that is going to be the world's greatest consumer market. In this country, we are, and in other parts of the world, we rush one place and then rush the other. Everyone is now just rushing to China. And I have no quarrel with that, because there is a lot to be done over there, and the Chinese economy is doing exceedingly well, even though politically they're not doing much. They're just the opposite, of course, from Russia. Just the opposite, where Russia has made political progress and slow economic progress. But inflation is going pretty well over in China right now. I think it's above 17% monthly, and it could. Anything that market is a big market, but the big market of the future for the American economy, those jobs that we're looking for, a great many of them are going to come if we get that economy functioning enough over there that they can really be purchasers of our goods and merchandise. It creates many American jobs, so we have a selfish economic stake in it also.
What do you want to see come out of the G7 summit meeting in terms of extending aid and support to Russia?
Well, I think more than extending aid and support, I think I speak of it in broader terms. I noticed, and I confirmed today the conversation, that they're in the $4 billion that the G7 was supposed to approve, we hoped would approve, and that President Clinton had urged they approve. A couple of the EC countries and Japanese have already said no, that $4 billion was entirely too much. And I don't treat that as very negative, and I think the important thing is not that they get $4 billion. If they had $4 billion today, they couldn't spend $100 of it usefully. It takes time. I think it's important, one, that they start a process that will continue over the years of getting that $4 billion fed into that economy in the proper way. I would also like to see them agree on how they're going to monitor the kind of support that we should be getting from the international institutions, everything from the World Bank to the IMF and others, and monitor what they're doing and what they're not doing and what we ought to do differently for this unique situation. And I think we ought to come out of there with an accord. I think my hope is and my belief is that even though this is going to be an extremely difficult G7 summit meeting for President Clinton, I think, more difficult than any of his predecessors have had, because he's going to a G7 summit meeting where the political leaders with whom he's going to be meeting are going to all having terrible problems at home. They're either in deep trouble or they're on their way out. And President Clinton is having his own political problems here getting his program in this country. I think he'll come out there as a leader of the free world, and I think that's what he needs to come out there. I think they need to agree on what they're going to do.
What did you mean when you said that power was beginning to move to the regions in Russia? And does that mean that there's a likelihood that there will be a further splintering of the Russian Republic?
I think that's one of the risks of it, that as power moves to Republic, but it really is very good. All the power has been centralized in Moscow for far too long since the communists came to power. And there has to be a decentralization. And if you're going to get anything done, local areas, local, whether it be at a local or a regional level, they're going to have to be able to make decisions, they're going to have to be able to implement decisions, they're going to have to see that the plants, for example, in their area get privatization support, that everything doesn't have to come through Russia. It's simply impossible to get anything done in Russia. You know, we built a bureaucracy over here, but bad as it is, every now and then something decent can wiggle its way through. It's rare in our own bureaucracy, but it is humanly possible to get something through our bureaucracy. Rare, but possible. In Russia, it's damn near impossible. They've developed a system in a year and a half, less than 2 years of struggling with democracy, that is simply foolproof. Nothing can move.
What is the expected evolution of the CIS agreement with regard to joint military forces and economic unions, and how will the relationship between Ukraine and Russia affect this?
Well, I don't know what the relationship between Ukraine and Russia is to begin with, and one of the reasons I don't know, as smart as I sometimes think I am, is because they don't know, and it's different every day. And I think there are two leaders who know they have to hang together or hang separately, and that's the basis of the relationship right now. We have a big, big stake in that. As you know, we have nuclear weapons. Strategic weapons are still in Belarus and still in Ukraine and Kazakhstan, and as well as in Russia. The tactical weapons are all back on Russian soil, and I think we can feel pretty comfortable about that. The strategic ones are going to be out there for a long, long time. If we had all the money we needed, it would take a minimum of $10 to $12 billion. And if we were spending it as fast as we could to take care of, to get rid of these strategic weapons, it's a minimum of a 10-year job. That's assuming we had all the talent and all the will and all the cooperation. It's that long and that tough. And it is something to be not alarmed about, but concerned about. In terms of CIS republics, I think there's a good chance that five or six of them will hang together and will have some loose economic federation. Maybe they'll even have some common central banking structure, or the ones that have enough interrelation with each other to function better. I don't think they will have a common military. I wish they would. But I think it's going to be doubtful. But maybe they'll make some progress along that line. Happily, the military in Russia, is very supportive of democracy, very supportive of President Yeltsin. I will tell you that our military here has done a good job. President Bush did a good job, and Jim Baker and others of getting. We didn't do much for them in a way of money and other things, but we had good exchange between our military and theirs. I was fortunate enough to be able to get a number of the leadership of the KGB as well as the military over visiting with our CIA and our military, and seeing how civilian oversight doesn't have to weaken those processes, and we had our people over there. So there's progress being made in those areas, and I think we can take great credit for that.
Should the U.S. condition aid to Russians so that they remove their troops from the Baltics?
I think you have to be very careful about conditionality. I think it plays, it's very tough to play, very tough hand to play. It's very delicate, and I'm not sure we have the skills to do it very well here. And to get the troops home from the Balkans, they have to have some place to put them. Now, one of the things I would like to see us do, I think an area where we could do very well is in housing, but we just can't seem to get over the hump. But if they have lumber and they have hardware and they have cement, they lack a lot of skills for mass production and things that we have. But I think if we put a modest amount of money, we could build 100,000 or so housing units and expand them and keep expanding them without a lot of capital investment of Western capital. And that would provide jobs over there. It would also provide housing where they could begin to bring the troops home. President Yeltsin has a great difficulty. Some say, well, he doesn't want to bring them home. Well, maybe he does or doesn't, that he wants to keep his troops out in those places to keep the peace. That may or may not be true, but if he wants to, the problem is the worst thing he can do is bring a lot of military people home and have no job and have no housing. And these are families that have lived, these are not just troops have been assigned 6 weeks, these are families that have lived 5, 10, 15 years in these areas, and you're uprooting them and their families and their children and their grandchildren and bringing them home to what? Well, first you have to bring them home to a roof over their head, and that's a program that I think we could do very well and should do.
Japan is somewhat reluctant to join in the G7 effort to assist Russia because of her territorial issue. What would you say to the Japanese to urge them to cooperate more actively?
Well, it's not what I would say, it's what I did say to them, and it doesn't take a rocket scientist again to know what to say to them, and that is they don't get it. And that is, Boris Yeltsin couldn't deal with the question of the islands if he wanted to. It would end his, he would be through politically. It is as politically volatile as anything I can think of. If he were to say, well, I have given up those islands there, he wouldn't be present very long. And I urge the Japanese to recognize the political reality of it and the fact that they had a man who did understand the problem, who said, I will solve it in time, give me time, and put that issue over on the side and come back and revisit in a few years when something can be done about it. That would be, I think, the wisest course for Japan and the most constructive course for the relationship between the two countries, and it's important that they have a good relationship, important to them and important to us.
Changing subjects, is President Clinton giving Latin America the attention it deserves? Do you think there is a need for increased attention to the region?
I think Latin America is, I don't think Latin America has ever had the attention in the last, in modern times that it deserves from this country. That includes today and last year and the previous administrations. I just don't think it's had it. There's great opportunity there now, and you can start, before you get all the way to Latin America, you can start from Mexico and go on down, and there's a great deal taking place, and most of it good in that part of the world, and I hope what happens is the old story of the squeaking wheel. It's, they seem most places are getting along passably well anyway, and so you tend to direct your attention. There's just so much attention and so much manpower and so much money you have available, and I think we've put it in things we thought were more desperate situations, and I think Latin America needs more attention, and I think hopefully it will get it.
What do you think the prospects are for approval of the NAFTA agreement, and how do you think President Clinton has handled it so far?
I think I'm going to be in the minority here, but I think that NAFTA will be approved, and I think there's a chance it will be approved this year. Is it 50-50 it'll be approved this year? I don't know, but I hope so. I think we need it. I think it's going to be very tough to get done. I think Ross Perot has some credibility at country out in the countryside, and he's going to make it very tough. I hope that he will change his posture to some extent on that and ease up. My judgment is that you will see President Clinton and Majority Leader Bob Dole and other leading Democrats and other leading Republicans working together on this. I think the country would like to see them together. I think the country is tires of partisanship, and particularly on issues like that. And I think it would be very good for the country. It would be very good for each of the two parties and be very good for the political process in America if we found some areas of agreement to work on, and NAFTA is one that the Republican leadership, it really is a Republican agreement, you will recall. So it's easy for the Republicans to support it, and President Clinton and his administration support it. There's no reason why they can't work together very constructively. We'll all be better off.
Speaking of Mr. Perot, what do you think of his criticism of lobbyists as a lobbyist yourself?
Well, I hate to say this out loud. No one's going to believe it, and I'm so tired of people think I might misstate a fact. But even though I'm from Texas, I haven't lobbied anything in so long I can't remember. I was having breakfast with Bob Dole about a year or so ago, and he said, Strauss, when are you going to lobby me on something someday? We're good friends, so I don't want to speak as a lobbyist. I'm not opposed to being one, and we have a great many of them in our law firm. And I used to be a pretty damn good one. The last only effective lobbying I've done in a long time was lobbying for the Russian aid package, which we got through last year. And I'd say they had a damn good lobbyist, and without him, it wouldn't have gone through. And I know the reason I know he worked hard is because I was up half the night in Russia on the phone, calling people over here on the Hill. I got so wound up in the first part. What was the question?
What do you think of Mr. Perot's comments?
Oh, yeah, I think that Mr. Perot's comments are highly exaggerated, and I think American people have heard a distorted story of people who lobby in this town. There's nothing wrong with people being engaged to lobby the Congress. That's what this country is all about. And I personally resent on behalf, my own behalf and a lot of others, this idea that anyone's a lobbyist, there's something wrong with them. You've got a right. That's what the Congress is there for, to hear from the American people. And the American people have every right to engage someone to state their case. Now, if you ask me, do I think we ought to have a lot more control over what takes place over there, and on finance, we don't need a lot of reform of the process, that we definitely do. I think it needs reform desperately. I think it's going to get some this year, but not all we should get, and I applaud those that are working on it. But that's what we need, is to make the process, improve the process, not get rid of lobbyists. And that's my view of it.
Well, how do you feel about President Clinton's restrictions on lobbyists, lobbying by members of his administration who leave for the private sector?
Well, I don't really know what they are, what his restrictions are. I would say one thing. I think if President Clinton could improve his lobbying effort, be a hell of a lot better than weakening it. And I think the country would be better off if he did, and I hope he will. And if he hired me for that, I might go to work as a lobbyist. No, I don't want a job. I'm too old.
Moving to Texas, what do you think Texas Democrats need to do to win back the U.S. Senate seat there?
How much time do you have? The Texas Democratic Party has got a lot of problems. I'll take a minute and tell you about it. The core Democratic vote is getting smaller in Texas, not larger. And I don't think Texas is going to have great trouble with any statewide race that takes place unless it is a presidential year, when the Democrats can get out their broad support of the minorities in Texas. And we don't get a minority vote out very well for ordinary races, and only when the presidential race is involved. So I think they've got a lot of problems. I think it's far too small, that the Democratic Party, it isn't broad enough in Texas, should be broader based. We're losing people we shouldn't lose.
The space station's funding barely survived a vote yesterday, and the superconducting supercollider funding is in jeopardy. Does this mean that Texas is losing its clout in Washington?
I don't know. I think that that Texas, I think people tend to forget when you talk about Texas clout that it is different today. You have to remember that a lot of good things happened to Texas that involved the federal government over many, many years. And an awful lot of that, as a Democrat, let me say, an awful lot of that was, you can go back and talk about Mr. Rayburn, and you can talk about former President Johnson, and you can talk about former President George Bush, and you can talk about a lot of other people. But we have had that kind of leadership. We also had Lloyd Benson, who we've lost, which is a terrible loss right now, and he's been the power down there. And yes, I would say Texas is losing its clout.
Since you are a betting man, give us your prediction. Where will Texas Governor Ann Richards be 8 years from now?
8 years from now, my God. I don't know where she's going to be tomorrow. My judgment is that Ann Richards will run for re-election. My judgment is she will have a hard campaign. And my judgment is she, if I had a bet, I would bet on her winning it. And if I had to give odds, if Las Vegas were to call me right now and say, Bob, what kind of odds should we lay on far against Ann Richards getting elected, I'd probably say, give 55% to 45%, make it about that way, that she'll be the favorite for re-election. My guess is that she'll run against a strong Republican. It could be the son of the former president, George Bush, is taking a hard look at it, and he would be an attractive candidate for the Republicans. I think he would also probably be a losing candidate. I think Ann is going to be tough to beat. She's had to do too many things. State, like many states, has had too many problems for her to be anywhere near as popular as she was 3 years ago. But people have some understanding of that. They like Ann Richards. She's sort of a quintessential Texan in many respects, and she'd be tough to beat. Furthermore, she's tough, period.
Why hasn't the White House brought in more Democratic veterans like yourself to help President Clinton?
Well, the reason they haven't brought in Democratic veterans like myself is I don't belong there. This is a generational change. I'm 74 years of age, and it's time for people that are much younger than I am. I would hope, and I rather expect that there will be a bit more seasoning in and around the White House before too many moons have passed, and I think it will be helpful. I think they've got some bright young people over there who ran a marvelous campaign, and I think they do need, there are too few people who understand a bit of the process here. It's a culture shock to come from anywhere into Washington, as those of you, your Washingtonians, know. This is no easy town. This is one tough little community to come into, and you need some help. And when I compare the kind of help, I think Jim Baker was about as effective a chief of staff as any president could have. All you have to do is look at the Reagan administration to see how splendidly he functioned there. But Jim Baker will be the first to tell you that he had four, five, or six real heavyweights, and you had to pick up a problem in one room and move it to the next room and get it out of the way, or he'd go on and do something else. I mean, he had people like David Gergen who just legged men on his staff, and he had a fellow who ended up being head of OMB on his staff. He had a fellow who ended up being chief of staff, Duberstein, on his staff. These were all heavyweight people helping that very able, uniquely gifted fellow, Jim Baker, run his business. He wouldn't have looked very good either without any help, and he's the first to tell you. That's the reason he put good help in, because he knew he needed it. And President Clinton and his people will beef up that staff, I'm sure. They've already started, and I think, you know, I'm not one of those very discouraged about President Clinton. I'm very encouraged about him. I think he's made some mistakes, unquestionably. They've had some bad breaks, and they've had some errors in judgment, but they haven't been happily on anything big. You look at his record of accomplishment up to now and the things he has going, it looks pretty darn good. And his mistakes have been on frivolous, insignificant, incidental matters that are just simply tremendous for those of you in the press to write about, and they're titillating to read about. But if you stop and think, you can't think of a mistake on a matter of any significance, a really substantive issue that they've blown. And I think President Clinton, by this time next year, will be in altogether a different political shape than you see him today. I'm just not that alarmed by it.
Before asking the final question, I'd like to present you with a certificate of appreciation from the National Press Club. I'm sure you have a few of those already.
Well, I'll tell you this. This wouldn't offend anybody's new legislation on the value of your gift received for participating, but I'm happy to have it.
But we're not done yet. You also get a National Press Club mug.
Oh, thank you. May I conclude?
Sure.
Or?
I have one more question.
Go ahead. No, I'll.
Okay. If President Clinton is to visit Russia, how much would it cost to get his haircut in Moscow?
Well, I'm glad I was reminded we're back at the Press Club, Washington Press Club. Let me conclude by saying to each of you what you know, I'm sure, without my telling you, and that is I've enjoyed being with you today a good deal more than you've enjoyed having me. It's marvelous being here, and I hope you ask me back. Thank you very much.